Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, American original. Cornel West calls himself a Shiloh Baptist and a blues man. But this is not your everyday blues man. 19 books, 20 honorary degrees, a professor at Harvard, now Princeton, a one-of-a-kind philosopher, thinker, teacher with some hip-hop on the side, a role in The Matrix, and now a new memoir, Brother West. This hour, On Point Life and Cornel West. You can join the conversation. Is Cornel West your man, your visionary, your teacher, your prophet, or not? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Cornel West joins me now from Princeton, New Jersey, a renowned teacher, provocative thinker. He is now professor at the Center for African American Studies at Princeton University, author of the best-selling Race Matters and Democracy Matters. He's put out a hip-hop CD, Sketches of My Culture, and he's even had a stint in Hollywood playing a Council of Zion elder in the movies The Matrix Reloaded and The Matrix Revolution. His new memoir, written with David Ritz, is Brother West, Living and Loving Out Loud. Henry Louis Gates Jr. calls West one of the preeminent African-American intellectuals of our generation. Cornel West, welcome back to On Point. Good to have you.
Always a blessing. Thank you so very much, my dear brother Tom, and I salute you for being such a force for good, I tell you.
A force for good. I don't know if I'm worthy, but I have to say I really enjoyed this. There's a lot in this book I didn't know. Learned a lot about you, thinking where to dive in. You keep coming back. There's a lot you come back to, but you keep coming back to you being a Shiloh Baptist. For someone who's never met you, what does that mean, Cornel West?
Yeah, Shiloh Baptist kind of brother means I am a love child, that I was able to have a childhood saturated with love with the West family. I'm first and foremost my mother's child and my daddy's kid, Irene and Cliff's kid. Mm-hmm. And Irene and Cliff were inseparable from Shiloh Baptist Church, Reverend Willie P. Cook, Deacon Hinton, my Sunday school teacher, Sarah Ray, all the people who shaped and molded me, because as you know, early on, I was a thug and a gangster. I had a Robin Hood kind of mentality, would redistribute goods in a coercive manner when the young people, Starville had two sugar daddies and Linda didn't have them. All of a sudden, there was an egalitarian situation. So that I had a rage and I needed to find positive channels for that rage. And Shiloh Baptist, as well as education, it was really power of love and power of education at the center of the book. Those two powers helped shape me so that my raw rage could become a righteous indignation against injustice rather than the kind of anger that would devour my soul and push me to drink from the cup of bitterness.
Born in Tulsa, raised in Sacramento, California. Your mother, a school teacher and then school principal. School's named after her now.
Yeah.
Your dad bought and sold what? Fighter jet parts at the nearby air base there.
McClellan Air Force Base, absolutely. And I tell you, I wish you could have met my father, Brother Tom. If I can be one half the person he was, I would not have lived in vain, I tell you that.
Well, take us.
He died 15 years ago.
Yes, and he was much on your mind later in your life. We'll talk about that at some key points in your life. Give us a sense of the character of your mother and father that raised a kind of a holy smokes kid like you. And I know it wasn't just you. Your brother Cliff, you're very close to, and your two sisters. You and I each have a sister named Cynthia. That's not so common these days.
It's a beautiful name, isn't it?
It is a beautiful name.
Oh, yes.
But what were the, I don't know, what was the outlook they had, your parents, on the world that shaped you?
They had just an unbreakable self-confidence and ineradicable self-respect. And self-confidence and self-respect, those two pillars that they passed on to Clifton and Cornell and Cynthia and Cheryl, allowed us to confront the world in such a way that we would never demonize others but criticize others, that we could always stand in our own truths and at the same time be open to the truths of others. And, of course, who they were, again, is inseparable from their Christian faith. They're just deeply Jesus-loving persons, not in the sense of just talking about it, but being it. They were sermons rather than gave sermons.
There's a lot of talk and examples of love in this book, but there's plenty of rage as well. If you take us a little further back up your family tree, there's a kind of heartbreaking story of your mother's mother and her father, who was no pacifist guy, Daddy in your family.
Oh, Big Daddy. Indeed. Granddaddy, Nick Bias. Nick Bias of Crawley, Louisiana. And He had married a lovely, lovely Creole girl. She had given birth to three children, my mother being the youngest. When my mother was just 9 months old, she had a bad tooth. She went to the doctor. She searched for the doctor. There's only one black doctor in town. He was away. Went to the white hospital. They would not allow her in, and she died on the steps. He pulled out his shotgun. His friends, he was on the deacon board of the Baptist church there. His friends said, no, you got to leave town, and he ended up going to Orange, Texas, and that's where my precious, priceless mother grew up, in Orange, Texas, as a result of that encounter. Of course, my mother never knew her biological mother. The only mother she knew was T. Rose, who was my grandmother, whose step-grandmother, her stepmother, who's still alive, 93 years old. God bless her soul.
But Big Daddy was not one to back down easily. His friends had to almost drag him out of town so he didn't
go back
after that hospital whose inattention led to the death of your grandmother, I guess.
She was maladjusted to injustice, and he taught us that, too.
You were called Little Ronnie. When you were 7 years old, your brother Cliff was 10. 1961, he announced to you that you two were going to come to Jesus, be baptized. And you were. At the same time, you describe yourself, Little Ronnie in those days, from your middle name, as a boy whose hands were often sore from fighting, a boy filled with rage. So, you know, was it come to Jesus? Was it rage? Was it both? Do you have to carry both?
Well, yeah, I never could fully account for the rage because it was not Oedipal. It wasn't against Mom and Dad. I just had a rebellious spirit, and I needed to find some positive venues for it. And early on, it took a very coercive and violent form, and, of course, culminating when I was kicked out of school in the third grade when I refused to salute the flag. I had just gone back to Jim Crow, Texas, spent time with my grandparents and heard stories about my great uncle who had been lynched, and he wrapped his body in the flag as he hung from the tree. And so when I went back to Sacramento, I had those memories of the flag, of those associations with the flag, refused to salute it. And Mrs. Yee, sweet, lovely woman, really slapped me pretty intensely.
She said, and, "You will pledge allegiance to the flag, and you socked her."
To this flag. She slapped me, and I had a Joe Frazier counterpunch. Yeah, I was wrong, but
and you
I
were
got
out
in
of
deep
that school.
Trouble there, bro. Yeah, I was out of that school. In fact, no school in that district would take me.
It led your mother to get an IQ test for you, 168, no mean score, and a whole new school for gifted children, Cornell West.
Yeah, all across town, from the chocolate slice to the vanilla slice. Absolutely.
Was that it? Was it a white environment when you got to that school?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
How was that for Angry Ronnie?
Well, I tell you, it turned out to be very nice. There's a German brother named Gary Schroeder. My closest friend was Randy Arai, who was a Chinese brother. We meant the world to each other. And most importantly, I had two magnificent teachers, white sisters, Nona Saul and Cecilia Angel. I remember them as long as I live.
But you managed to get in there pretty well. You ended up president of the school or your class. I mean, you got
American
the votes
Legion
of the
Award. Yeah, that's true. And I skipped a grade too. Ended up skipping a grade there.
Along the way, ended up as an undergraduate at Harvard. Did that in 3 years, and then off to Princeton. What was it like to come from, you know, family out of Louisiana and Tulsa and Sacramento, and then into the as a student into the academic groves of Harvard?
Oh, there's an excitement that I don't have a language for, because I tell you, Harvard, you know, that intellectual ferment there, the libraries. I've been used to going to a bookmobile and read every book in the bookmobile. By the time I got to White in the library, I said, oh, my God, this is intellectual heaven. At the same time, of course, I joined the breakfast program, the Black Panther Party. I could never join the party because as a Jesus-loving, free black man, they were secular and atheistic, but I worked very closely with them because I loved their love for poor people. And so I worked in the breakfast program and the prison program, so I had community work on the one hand and this tremendous intellectual ferment going on the other hand there at Harvard. I shall forever be in deep debt to Harvard. I love that place in terms of what it helped me do, which has helped sharpen my armor, give me the kind of intellectual weaponry to bear witness to truth and justice.
What do you mean when you say that you're a blues man and a jazz man? You say, I'm a blues man in the life of the mind, a jazz man in the world of ideas. I guess we can hear it, but describe for us what you mean when you say that.
Yeah, see, for me, a blues man, a blues woman, very serious thing, and, you know, very serious. You're talking about not just B.B. King and Mart Rainey, but you're talking about Toni Morrison, you're talking about Lorca, you're talking about Tennessee Williams, you're talking about Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, you're talking about Sterling Brown. These are people who have a vocation, not just a profession, they have a calling, not just a career, and they're trying to find their unique voice. They don't want just to be an echo. Their voice, and you can't find your voice unless you really wrestle with the dark corners of your own soul, those untapped precincts of your own personality where you'd rather not go. And you find that voice, and then you want to spread that voice. And like a blues man and blues woman, you hit the road. You're disciplined. You are sacrificial. You're willing to do what it takes to spread your blues all around the country and the world so people can actually hear your voice and wrestle with the vision that comes out of your voice, sustain your vocation, and most importantly, be true to yourself.
Do we have to have the blues? You write in here somewhere that the whole world has the blues now, given some of the tough things we've been through. Is it right to have the blues?
But there's two definitions of the blues. I mean, on the one hand, having the blues means just being down and out. But singing the blues allows you to deal with your condition of being down and out in such a way that you don't succumb to revenge and bigotry and hatred, but rather you have a compassion, you have a courage to forge ahead with a vision that is best for all. So when we talk about black people being a blues people, for example, where you've got slavery 244 years, here comes a blues man, Frederick Douglass, that says what? I will not call for the enslavement of others. I am enslaved. I call for the freedom for everybody. Martin King, the same thing in the face of Jim Crow and Jane Crow. We are being terrorized. We do not create a black al-Qaeda and terrorize others. We want rights and liberties for everybody. The blues man or blues woman has a love ethic shot through what they sing and what they do.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with American original Cornel West, philosopher, teacher, lightning rod, about his life and new memoir, Brother West, Living and Loving Out Loud. He joins us today from Princeton, New Jersey. He's a professor at Princeton. Brother West is the memoir. And if you'd be so kind, let's bring listeners in right here. They've got questions for you. Louise in Saranac Lake, New York. You're on the air with Cornel West.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I love your show.
Thank you.
I am very fond of Princeton. I'm delighted that Cornel West came home to Princeton. We're a Princeton family. I wanted to ask, please, Cornel West, would you comment on the Gates Obama tuzzed up, the beer drinkers?
the Cambridge policeman, Harvard professor Henry Louis Skip Gates, their standoff at his house in Cambridge, the beer in the White House lawn. What'd you make of all that, Dr. West?
Well, first, I just want to salute my fellow Princetonian. I tell you, we've got a rich legacy here at Princeton, very much so, and it's beloved, my beloved Princeton in so many ways. But no, the issue had to do with arbitrary police power, that it was clear that, okay, either both persons may have said and done things they shouldn't have done, but you don't walk into a person's house without their permission. That's already arbitrary police power. And even though Skip himself, relatively privileged, towering intellectual, not just towering black intellectually, but a towering intellectual, that the issue of arbitrary police power relates much more intimately to poor people, working people. They have to deal with this every day. This was very alien for Skip's experience. It was new for him. Other people have to deal with it all the time. So I thought it had to be cast in such a way that the issue of arbitrary police power, which is always the litmus test for a democracy. A democratic society has a rule of law, which means it tries to curtail arbitrary police power. There's nothing wrong with fair police power, just police power, but arbitrary police power has to be called into question. And it seems to me the minute he walked into Skip's house without permission, that was arbitrary police power, and that was the issue that needed to be highlighted. But it ended up being trivialized. The next thing you know, they're drinking beer
in
the White House.
What if he thought there was maybe a burglary going on and he needed to check it out? Was there a thin skin issue here as well, not just a white and black skin?
You have to ask for permission, though, brother. You got to ask for permission. Police can't just walk into your house without permission. Man.
I guess
you have to ask for permission. You see what I mean?
Well, of course, if they understand that it's your house.
Absolutely. And you're there. And now, if in fact, you know, Skip's in trouble, he invites them in, please come in and help. Yes, because our police at their best, they serve us. At their worst, they have a prerogative and an arrogance of just moving right in and doing crossing the line, as it were, without the kind of in this case, permission of the person who was in the house.
There's a kind of disrespect there, maybe, to say the least, while we're in those precincts of Harvard. I know you've told the story, but tell us again.
Whatever the motivation, I don't believe it was just about race. I mean, it could have been about class. It could have been, you know, police, working class, skip, upper middle class. But see, for me, it's not a question of the motivation. Arbitrary police power relates to poor whites, poor brown, upper middle class whites, Jews, Catholics. It has to be fair across the board. There's a lot of motivations for why police are arbitrary. Sometimes it is racist, but that's not the only one.
You sat in the office of the president of Harvard University, Larry Summers, who is now kind of at the right hand of Obama, President Obama, and came face to face with a notion you outline in the book. You say the college professor as blues man isn't a concept easily embraced by the college president. Do tell.
Well, yeah, that incident about 7 years ago, my dear brother Larry Summers, of course, as a Christian, I forgive the brother. I just hope and pray he has more joy in his life, because he does, I think, have difficulty treating people with respect and decency. But in my case, I think it was even more arbitrary than most, because I'd never met him before. And I walk in the office and he starts cussing. I don't like people who just assume that it's congenial with me to be
profane.
The person to use profanity. Mm. You know what I mean? Mm. Help me F up Harvey Mansfield. Well, you see, I'm a Christian, but not a Puritan. I don't mind cussing in general, especially if you cuss with rhythm. But at the same time, don't assume that for me, all of a sudden, because I'm a black man or whatever, that you can just come in cussing like that. And it just happens to be the case that Harvey Mansfield is a brother of mine. He's conservative, right wing. We've had debates. We've had 1,200 people in Sanders Theater debating affirmative action. But after, we go off and have a drink because we were friends. So that when he started in that way, I knew something was wrong. And by the time he got to, well, your hip-hop CD is an embarrassment. Well, no, I believe in paideia, in deep education. I can do that with a danceable education, singing education, textual education. I'm going to reach these young people no matter what. If the young people are into ballet, I'm going to take off my three-piece suit and get in a ballet suit in ballet. I'm going to relate to them, communicate with them, because I want to affect their minds and hearts and souls. And going on, you're supporting candidates nobody respects, Ralph Nader and Al Sharpton. I'm thinking, well, I love both of those brothers, you know. So that it became very clear. And by the time he said, I want to monitor your work, I want to meet you every 2 weeks to see how you're working on a manuscript, I said, he thinks I'm some kind of off-the-wall graduate student. He is losing his mind. He is messing with the wrong brother, messing with the wrong Negro. So at that point, my righteous indignation is there. But the worst thing was...
And you were up and out and gone, out of Harvard, off to Princeton.
Well, no, I had a second meeting. We had a second meeting. You see, in that second meeting, he apologized 3 times. It was very, very kind. He's a cancer survivor. I'm a cancer survivor. I had cancer at the time. I hadn't survived it yet. But we had a bonding. But then when the New York Times reported that, lo and behold, he said he never apologized, I called him up and said, you apologized 3 times. New York Times said no. He said, I told him that I did apologize, but turns out I know somebody in New York Times. And they said, he unequivocally said he didn't apologize, would never apologize. I said, look, I'm dealing with an unprincipled power player. I got to go. Life is too short. My calling is such that I can't have a president who I can't trust. He's unreliable. He lacked integrity.
Now he's at the right hand of President Obama. What do you make of that?
I think Obama has been mesmerized by the braininess, by the brilliance. There's no doubt that Brother Larry Summers is a brainy, a brilliant person. But at the same time, he's tied to a neoliberal project. I think it's very, very sad that Obama chose not just Larry Summers. He chose a whole group of neoliberal economists. He needs to listen to Paul Krugman. He needs to listen to Joseph Stiglitz. He needs to listen to Sylvia Ann Hewlett and others. But I think Obama in general has been mesmerized not just by Wall Street but by the establishment. He had to reassure the establishment when he went in. And it's clear that given his democratic rhetoric, he's generating technocratic policies. And even though I was a critical supporter from Iowa all the way to Ohio, I'm a major, major critic of his economic policy. Look at the way jobs is an afterthought. So they're talking about the recession's over. But when you look at the social misery in working class communities and poor communities, you figure, well, it's a recovery for Wall Street, but working class people, Main Street, still catching hell. That is what you get when you have a neoliberal economic model, in which you have to make sure that the well-to-do are first secured, and jobs and working people, and tack on some unemployment benefits that are extended, maybe engage in some tax credits, because that's a second thought. Well, you see, my framework is the exact opposite. I put poor and working people at the center, and the well-to-do are alongside. And so Summers comes right out of the Robin Rubin legacy, which has really led towards some disastrous policies in regard to poor and working people.
You write in the memoir, Brother West, you say, my constant worry, this is about President Barack Obama, my constant worry, you write, is that he can be easily mesmerized by fast-talking establishment figures whose braininess lacks wisdom, vision, and commitment. And you say, this dangerous strategy moves toward the center for likability when often the truth lies not in the middle but beneath the mediocrity of the superficial exchange. How do you think this country would respond if Barack Obama was not so focused on, you know, moving toward likability, on kind of keeping people calm and cool? I mean, you know, what if he really stood up with a strident message? How would that go down?
But my dear brother, Barack Obama says he wants to be a Lincoln. He wants to be an FDR. What did they do? Mm-hmm. They shifted from being politicians to statesmen when they drew a line in the sand, took a stand, said, I know I will have vociferous foes, but I'm standing on principle. It's not solely about calculation and some kind of opportunistic deliberation. So if you're going to be a politician, you end up being a Bill Clinton. If you're going to be a statesman, you end up being a Lincoln, the FDR. The choice is clear. So far, he's a Bill Clinton.
Cornel West is with us. His new memoir is Brother West, Living and Loving Out Loud. We've got a lot of callers. Cornel West, Jeffrey in Charlotte, North Carolina. You're on the air with Cornel West.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I am particularly interested in your conversation about integrous leadership. As a graduate of Morehouse College, the specific mission of the college is to focus on leadership for young African-American males at the ages of 18 to 25. Right now, there's a story reported on CNN about a dress code, a bit of a controversy in dress code with respect to the college, putting forth more stringent rules for entering the cafeteria, entering administration buildings, for instance.
Even in college, at Morehouse College. Interesting.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. So I'm really interested in Dr. West's perspective on leadership for young African-American males in light of this this recent news story. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Cornel West.
No, thank you so much, Brother Jeffrey. I was blessed to actually attend the graduation at Morehouse. It brought tears to my eyes when I saw those 450 black brothers not only graduate but put that hood over each other's head. It was powerful. I was also blessed to give the commencement address at Spelman that night with 600 sisters graduated. Morehouse has one of the greatest histories when it comes to producing high-quality black leadership, and I know Brother Robert Franklin. He's a dear brother of mine. We were at Harvard together, and I was just with him during the graduation. But I say this, though. I'm not one to get excited about dress codes, though. I'm much more concerned about what's inside the heart, mind, soul of people than what clothes they have on. Now, Franklin has his reasons, and I'm sure that he's got plausible arguments, but I'm not big on dress codes. I think people ought to be free to dress the way they want. I'm not really that worried about the brother walking around with baggy pants if he's spending a whole lot of time in the library reading Du Bois and C.L.R. James and Toni Morrison and Shakespeare and Tennessee Williams and listen to some Stephen Sondheim musicals. At the same time, the brother walking around with a tie, if it's just all tie and all appearance and has no substance, then that's the challenge. But I'm sure he has his reasons. But most importantly, we've got to keep alive the Morehouse that produced the Martin Luther King Jr.'s and the Benjamin Mays's, who, of course, were responsible for shaping Martin King and so many others.
You know, I wonder what it is. Jeffrey asks about leadership for young black Americans. I wonder, Cornel West, what it is. I've seen crowds of young black Americans respond to you personally and have colleagues who've, you know, been in big amphitheaters where the big audiences just went crazy for your particular brand of interpretation of the world. When they're standing up and getting in a rapture for Cornel West, what are they responding to that, let's say, Larry Summers might have missed? What's it about?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, for me, I know that I am but a very brief instant and moment in a rich tradition. So when they're responding to me, what I hope they're responding to is someone who's trying to keep alive the kind of energy, vitality, the kind of vision, the kind of commitment, and the acknowledgement of inadequacy of those who came before me. It could be Douglass on the one hand, it could be Fannie Lou Hamer, Ella Baker on the other, or it could be Miles Horton, the white brother who founded Highlander Center. It could be one of my heroes, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, that we're part of a tradition. Who we are is in no way just, you know, we're isolated monads. As you know, the book calls into question the American myth of the self-made man. I am not self-made. I am who I am because I've been loved. Somebody cared for me. Somebody attended. They shaped me. They molded me. And all I'm doing is making available this tradition to other people because there's not enough people out there who are making that tradition available. And I think in many ways, my dear brother Larry Summers, he's really not he's not that interested in that tradition. You see, he's on a different vibe. He's a different register. And he has a right to do that. I mean, in a democratic society, I will fight for his right to express himself on whatever issue it is. But I do, at least in my own personal case, I do call for respect. I draw a line in the sand. I will not be disrespected or dishonored. Life's too short, and people have worked too hard to shape me. Mm.
Cornel West is with us. Everett's calling from Norfolk, Virginia. Everett, you're on the air.
Dr. West, how are you today, sir?
How you doing, my dear brother?
I'm doing great. Sir, I am 50 years old. I spent 30 years in the United States Navy, and I have a daughter who is 30 years old. And I just wanted to ask you about that generation. I don't think that they have the same appreciation, and I don't know if there's a real definition of our culture, of where we came from, who we are and why they are the way they are. I remember distinctly sleeping on the front porch in the summer of 1968 and watching the National Guard ride down the street with shiny helmets and all that kind of stuff. But they have never had to experience any of that. Can you talk a little bit about how we can expand their awareness of who they are, and not just through hip hop? I don't necessarily believe that is an identity.
Mm. Everett, thank you very much. Cornel West, your response.
Yeah, I appreciate the question. No, I think the important thing to keep in mind is that young people grew up during the age of Reagan, 1980 to 2009. One of the wonderful things about Brother Barack Obama, he brought the age of Reagan to a close. He brought the era of conservatism to a close. By age of Reagan and era of conservatism, what I mean is greed run amok. Greed viewed as a good thing. Indifference to the poor viewed as normal. Manipulate, polarize the body politic. Keep the body politic divided. That's why Karl Rove could be viewed as a quote-unquote political genius, because he was a master at dividing. Young people are exposed to a world in which greed is good, indifference to the poor is accepted, and manipulation is a way of life. What does that mean? It means that for them, success is at the center of what it means to be human. They become addicted to success. Whereas the brother talking about the dogs, that's about greatness. Greatness and success are qualitatively different. Success has to do with financial prosperity. Greatness has to do with moral integrity.
And what about the connection of young black Americans to black American cultural tradition? Everett seems to see it missing, that connection.
Well, the black culture tradition is still alive, but that same black culture tradition during the age of Reagan itself becomes addicted to success. I mean, one of the reasons why I think he might have a critical disposition toward hip-hop is because hip-hop began with a quest for greatness, critiques of the order tied to a certain kind of deep spirituality like KRS-One, for example, or Rakim and Eric B. By the time you get to the 1990s, it's all about gangster talk. The gangster talk was reflecting the kind of gangster activity on Wall Street, the kind of gangster activity on the White House. They were just imitating what was going on in the larger society, the indifference toward other people's suffering and so forth, so that then becomes a dominant model for young people. Oh, you mean forget the Ten Commandments? We're preoccupied with the 11th Commandment. Get over by any means, thou shalt not get caught. Well, that's what they saw in the business world. When we read the business page right now, scandal after scandal. I tried to get away. I got caught. Tried to get away. I got caught. Young folk trying to do the same thing with less resources. That is not spiritually healthy.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with philosopher, teacher, lightning rod, Cornel West, about his life and new memoir, Brother West, Living and Loving Out Loud. He joins us today from Princeton, New Jersey, now a professor at Princeton. Cornel West, it's a memoir, it's personal, so I guess we can be personal. you and women. You've been married three times unsuccessfully. You go into some considerable detail on your relationships with women in this book and say you haven't quite figured it out yet. Tell us.
Well, I just hope somebody's praying for me, brother. You're absolutely right. I've been blessed with magnificent women in my life, and I've got a magnificent son, magnificent daughter, and a magnificent grandson. But you're absolutely right. I think part of it is I'm just on the move so much. When you lecture 150 times a year for over 25 years, and you're writing all the time, and you're being pulled in this way or that, you know, one of the basis of a deep, mature love is time and trust. You have to take the time and, of course, be able to generate that deep bond of trust. And I've tried. It's very much like Samuel Beckett in that has great prose fiction, worst word hold, try again, fail better.
Are you married to your work? Are you married to success instead of the woman?
Well, not so much success because I'm not really successful in terms of financial prosperity. I'm broke as the Ten Commandments financially.
Sorry to
that's
hear
just
that.
My life. No, but I mean, that's part of alimony and a lot of things,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So I got to stay on the move in terms of keeping my cash flow. But that's a blues man, too. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I'm certainly aspire to greatness. In fact, like John Coltrane, and you saw the chapter on Train.
That great hero
I really,
of yours.
It's not just the good for me, it's the holy as a Christian. I aspire to be a saint. But by a saint in the blues tradition, it's just a sinner who looks at the world through the lens of the heart. I'm a dead-up sinner, a redeemed sinner who tries to look at the world through the lens of the heart, which means that I try to have a hypersensitivity to the feelings of others, including the women I fall in love with. So oftentimes I got to leave because I love. That's why Eddie Kendrick's song, Tell Her Love Has Felt the Need to Leave Her. Tell Her Love Has Felt the Need to Free Her. I could never be what she wants of me. If she wanted an ordinary husband who shows up from based on the job from 9 to 5, I'm not that kind of brother. But on the other hand, I do like love, though. I like to be in love. I like commitment. I'm not one to get into the messiness of a lot of different kind of relationships. I like one woman I can actually depend on, rely on, fall back on, engage in soul sharing. And I've been blessed to do that in a number of different ways. And I've had some women who really, you know, kind of saved my life, like Sister Leslie.
We read that all through the book, very big roles there, and yet you're the one who keeps on rolling. Mike in Nashville, Tennessee. Mike, you're on the air with Cornel West.
Thanks, Dr. West. I have a great deal of respect for you. I always enjoy listening to you speak.
Very kind. Appreciate it.
Why do you keep referring to yourself as a Christian? I guess I find that divisive. It's as if a Christian stands on a higher ground or is morally better equipped than, say, Muslims or agnostics to deal with issues. And I've known so many self-professed Christians that do not act like good people. And I
absolutely
sort of a turnoff to me. I just wonder why you keep saying that. I wish you would just be a human being that's so amazing without, you know, wrapping yourself around a belief system. Thanks.
No, I appreciate that question. No, but it's really just a matter of honesty, my brother. It's like saying I'm a mama's child or I'm from California or I like Luther Vandross and I like Frank Sinatra. It's just a matter of honesty. I don't think Christians have a monopoly on truth. We know that Christians have contributed in vicious ways, bigotry. There's Christians who are adjusted to hatred, adjusted to greed, and so forth. But it's just a matter of honesty. I think when we talk about a human being, you're always talking about somebody who is embodied in a body, in a tradition, in a community. In the same way, if I refer to myself as a black man, by saying a black man, I'm not being divisive. I'm just being honest. I am a human being in a black body. So I'm a human being who is a Christian, who loves Muslims, who loves atheists, who loves agnostics, who loves Buddhists, and so forth and so on. So I hope it's not a turnoff, but it's just a matter of honesty. If you come to me, for example, and say, well, Brother West, I'm an agnostic. Well, you know what? My hero's agnostic, Anton Chekhov. My other hero, Samuel Beckett, is an agnostic. My other hero was Benai Faith, Dizzy Gillespie. Each one of us have certain kinds of things that we treasure, and some treasure, you know, God. Some treasure art. There's a lot of different things that we express ourselves through and have ultimate concerns about.
But it's not just a factual category of upbringing that you're describing when you refer to your Christianity. I mean, all through this book, your theme of love and its sort of origins in your Shiloh Baptist upbringing is there. It's not just a point of origin. It's a point of departure. It is a philosophy of life for you.
No, absolutely. That's why I appreciate the brother's question, but I just want to try to say all that I can to him so that it's not a turn off, that it's not offensive, that he just recognizes that it's part and parcel of the baggage that I bring to the human being that I am. But all of us have baggage. If I had a chance to sit down and have coffee with the brother, I'm sure he'd have his own set of belief systems. It may be agnostic, it may be atheistic, the same way that I kick it with Bill Maher all the time. We joyfully engage in dialogue. He's a thoroughgoing agnostic brother. He knows I'm Christian.
Famously,
we overlap concerned with love, truth, justice. He's courageous. He's brilliant. We're comrades, and we proceed based on who we are.
You're focus on love and truth hasn't always brought love flowing back to you. In the early 90s, you came out with Race Matters. It was pretty successful. You were living large, big house, new wife from Ethiopia and all the rest. And I read in your memoir about the kind of blood-curdling situation where arms came into your life intended for you. And I don't mean loving arms.
No. Well, the death threats, of course, had already escalated once I appeared on TV and so forth. But when they showed up with a mask and put a gun to my wife's head.
In your home?
For me. In my home, right there in Newton. Absolutely. And then 2 weeks later, two white brothers are sitting there with shotguns. So that we had to move from Newton to a hotel downtown that had 24/7 security.
What was that about? What exactly do you think about you, your message, you provoked that? A gun with a silencer in your kitchen, a shotgun in your driveway.
Yeah, I think it was just, you know, TV appearances. But the same is true even these days. You make TV appearances. I mean, there are some sick brothers and sisters out there who resort to that kind of a threat and so on. It just goes with the territory. We're trying to bear witness to the truth and trying to bear witness to justice.
Are we past that now, or are we deeper in that territory?
Oh, no,
you saw the fever of August
in
this country.
Absolutely. Look at the brother Barack, folks showing up with shotguns at his rally, saying they have a right to know. Why don't you show up in front of a bank for about 45 minutes with loaded guns and see how long you last? Show up in the middle of in front of a police department with loaded guns for 45 minutes, see how long you last. No, we've got a lunatic fringe in the society, and unfortunately it's being fanned and fueled by some of the more popular talk radio folk, so that it's a dangerous situation. We've got a slice of our fellow citizenry who believes in that kind of a mode of threat, and you just have to deal with it. When you're a black man, you have to be even more cognizant of it because we've still got some a history of bigotry operating.
Let's get a call from Jim in Boston. Hi, Jim, you're on the air.
Thank you for the time, and I want to thank you to Professor West for the work you've done. I think you're a extension of the 8th century biblical prophets, and I want to say right on. A few years ago, I was teaching college English when your trouble came up with you still there?
Yes, we're here, Jim. You're on,
Jim.
I was teaching college English to senior high school students, most of whom were African American, and it was their last semester, and they weren't interested in doing anything. But I got your CD, and I played it in class, and I said, okay, I want you to write some essays on that, and they did.
Wow. Was this the hip-hop CD, Jim, that you were playing, or something else?
It was a CD that Cornel West, the rap CD.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
With the N-word on it. It really they really honed in, and I just think when Summers leveled that criticism, I thought, here's a guy who came out of the Clinton administration with neo-capitalist ideas, and he couldn't stand to have someone who was a socialist at Harvard University when he was president. Do you think there's any truth to that?
Are you a socialist, Cornel West? Was that your issue with Dr. Summers?
Well, I mean, Brother Summers didn't say so, but certainly I think my kind of commitment to poor people and working people was not something he was crazy about. You would hope he'd have brought enough libertarian sensibilities to know there's a whole host of members of the faculty at Harvard who have commitment to poor people and working people. My dear brother Hillary Putnam, for example, who probably one of the few philosophic geniuses alive, has as much commitment to poor as I do. So that could have been an element of it. When he talked about the candidates who I supported, Ralph Nader and Al Sharpton, I think that was a certain kind of ideological bias that he expressed. But I'm just so excited that my CD could be used in the high school that this brother's talking about. He didn't say exactly where that was, though, did he?
Jim's calling from Boston. So.
Oh, he's from Boston.
Yeah,
okay.
Maybe in that area. But there you were, in the classroom, in the air.
Isn't that beautiful?
And you got the response. Olamina in Beaufort, South Carolina. Olamina, you're on the air with Cornel West. Hello, Olamina.
Yes.
You're on.
Oh, I'm inquiring on reference to Cornel West in reference to, yes, I'm here. All right, thank you. Greeting, Cornel.
How you doing, my brother? Good to see you.
Good to hear from you. I was asking, since you was pushing this thing coming out of Harvard, what about Booker T. Washington theories? I see you taking a stand on Frederick Douglass.
Yes.
What about Booker T. Washington theory?
Thanks, Olamina. I hear your radio messing with you in the background, but how about it, Cornel West?
No, Booker T. Washington made major contribution. He was standing up in the face of American terrorism, of American Jim Crow and Jane Crow and lynching, and he was able to get some concessions from the white elite to get some money to build some magnificent institutions, beginning with Tuskegee, and moved on into newspapers and so forth and so on. He had a conservative sensibility in terms of not really supporting the organizing of workers and trade unions and so on. So he had a conservative side that I'm critical of, but I like to begin with people's positive side. I think Booker T. Washington, in many ways, made a major contribution given the very, very limited options under American terrorism he was working with. Now, if I had lived at that time, I probably wouldn't have been as close to Booker T. Washington as some of the others. I would have been much closer to Ida B. Wells Barnett. She's out there. Mm. You know, she's out there writing books on the red terror, hitting American terrorism head on and getting chased out of Tennessee with a bond on her head in terms of people willing to pay money to kill her. That's much more closer to my spirit. But I do have an appreciation for the Booker T. Washingtons of the world because I think the world is big enough for us to acknowledge the contributions of a variety of different kind of people.
You write in the memoir, speaking of Barack Obama, you say, as he aspires to be the black Lincoln, I, that is you, Cornel West, intend to be a blacker Frederick Douglass. What exactly do you mean by that?
Yeah, what I mean by that is oftentimes people get Lincoln mixed up. I know that Barack Obama's talked about Lincoln in terms of pushing toward bipartisanship and so on. But, you know, the first speech Lincoln gave, inaugural address, he accepted the first proposed 13th Amendment, which would have made slavery permanent in America. Mm-hmm. They call it the Unamendable Amendment. Frederick Douglass bought a ticket to go to Haiti forever for America to have slavery being permanent. He could not accept. That's not the great Lincoln. Lincoln became great when the social movement of abolitionism, when white brothers like Wendell Phillips and white brothers like Charles Sumner and white sisters like Harriet Beecher Stowe and especially black brothers like Frederick Douglass and black sisters like Harriet Tubman put pressure on him. So by the time 1863 comes along and he's signing the Emancipation Proclamation, he has changed his mind. He no longer is willing to concede to a white supremacist South. Lincoln began as a politician. He became a statesman in part because of the greatness of the social movement of abolitionists. And Barack Obama can only be great if there are mobilized citizens who put pressure on him in the name of poor and working people, not what is presently the case where he's getting pressure on behalf of investment bankers and corporate oligarchs and corporate elites and plutocrats.
Ike, Charleston, South Carolina, you're on the air with Cornel West.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I really have a great appreciation for you, Mr. West, and I'll just put up my hero, which would be J. Philip Randolph.
Decry
the fact that in the American public school system, black history is not taught worth 2 cents worth of anything. But do you see yourself, and I want to bridge this to my situation, white male, 50 years old, dealing with the economy, just as down and out as anybody you could ever meet. Do you see how your messages that you send out and the things that you're saying apply not only to your race but to us across the board? And do you see yourself as more of a populist than such a person just for their own particular race or genre?
Thank you, Ike.
Absolutely.
Cornel.
I deeply appreciate those kind words as well as the question. One, I am a deep Democrat, which means that I embrace poor people across color, and not just across in America. I embrace poor people in Asia, in Africa, in Europe. across the board. It is a question of being human. And issues of class, issues of empire are as important as issues of race. It has to do with injustice. Injustice takes a lot of different forms. I'm concerned about our gay brothers and lesbian sisters who have to deal with bigotry in the form of homophobia. I'm deeply concerned about you, my brother, because your humanity is just as precious as mine. And therefore, you could call it a populist. I just say deep Democrat, which means you're concerned about each and every one of us, regardless of race or creed or sexual orientation or gender.
You're right. I try to give heart to intellect, to give heart to intellect by being true to the funk of living. How's that project going?
Well, we're wrestling because all of us are featherless, two-legged, linguistically conscious creatures born between urine and feces, and our bodies will be the culinary delight of terrestrial worms one day, my brother. That's our humanity. You know, the English word human derives from the Latin humando, which means burial. Oh. We're all beings toward death. We're vanishing creatures. How can we love? How can we gain meaning? How can we leave the world just a little better? You know, my old church folks used to say, if the kingdom of God is within you, then everywhere you go, you ought to leave a little heaven behind. And how much heaven do we leave behind in the short time we have on earth? Oh, that's wisdom.
Play
from
on.
From the old folk.
That's play old school.
That's
play
Curtis
on.
Mayfield. That's Curtis Mayfield.
Cornel West, it's always great to have you.
Love you, though, brother Tom. Love
play
you, though,
on.
Man.
The new memoir is You Stay Strong as well. Thank you very much for being with us today. Cornel West, his new memoir is Brother West, Living and Loving Out Loud. Thank you very much for being here. Listeners, thanks to you for joining us as well. Let me tell you, On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wong, Alina Mata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. We got a Google job inquiry for one of those young kids we had on earlier this week. Very happy about that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.